All right, here we go. We finished talking about the crazy, amazing victory of the Six-Day War. Now, as I mentioned last time, Israel had only 200 planes in the Air Force. And yet, in all, the IAF destroyed 469 enemy planes, 50 of them in dogfights. The figures, in the air, fighting one against the
Israel.
50 of them. The rest of them, with all the bombings that we talked about before, they took out the planes right in the beginning of the attack. This is 85% of Egypt's combat aircraft and all its bombers. As R. Goring Morris, British Air Attaché in Tel Aviv, said, never in the history of military aviation has the exercise of air power played so speedy and decisive a part in warfare. Okay, and yet Israel lost 20% of its aircraft. 36 planes. 36 planes were shot down. 18 pilots were killed. And the Soviet Union swiftly replenished Egypt and Syria's MiGs, while Israel was no longer getting anything. Right? They had made requests from France. France at this point cuts them off, and from America, and it's all suspended. Okay? Other ideas that we need to know after the war. 325,000 Palestinians left for living in the West Bank, fled. And the same way we spoke after the War of Independence, where the Arabs sue for the right of return, they're going to do it again after 67 and say that, you know, they should be able to come back after they ran away. But it wasn't just refugees from one side. After the 67 war, Jews living in Arab countries, let's put it this way. You had riots, pogroms, mobs that started attacking in basically every major Arab city. In Egypt, in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Tunisia, in Morocco. They burned shuls. They assaulted people. One pogrom, as an example, in Tripoli, left 18 Jews dead and 25 injured. Tripoli is am I blanking?
Is it Greece?
No.
Tunisia?
It's in Libya. In Libya. Where Muammar Gaddafi was. Egypt had 4,000 Jews. 800 of them were arrested, including the chief rabbis of Cairo and Alexandria. Property was seized by the government. Same thing happened in Damascus and in Baghdad, where Jews were put under house arrest, leaders imprisoned and fined. A total of 7,000 Jews were kicked out of Damascus and Baghdad, being able to take a little satchel over their shoulder. That's what they carried out. Except for the king of Morocco, no leader actually even condemned the attacks. Okay? No leader condemned the attacks. Now, go.
Sorry, Ross.
It's really
interesting.
Now, the Palestinian community and Israel, in Israel, the religious leaders, for the most part, remained at pre-war positions, including, and this was very controversial, the Waqf on top of the Temple Mount. Moshe Dayan, criticized by many Israeli hawks, said they're going to remain in charge of the Temple Mount, run things the way things were done before. This is even after they found out that in the 19 years that they didn't allow, the Jordanians did not allow the Jews into the old city. They defiled shuls here, they destroyed things, they took tombstones and made latrines. They totally desecrated everything, and people were very upset. Not Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan said, no, we're going to let them continue to run things the way it was being run before. But one thing the government did do, anyone who's seen old pictures, the Kotel Maravi basically looked like the Shuk. It was a narrow alleyway. There were homes all the way pretty much up to the Kotel. And you had an alleyway, and people davened by the Kotel in this alleyway. But now, the government right away told the 130-some-odd Arab homes that were there, get out. They found them new places to live. They destroyed the homes, and they made the Kotel Plaza, which pretty much becomes the Beit Knesset HaMerkazi, not just for Israel, but for world Jewry. Right? As you know, guys lucky enough to be here, you know, you can go down to the Kotel basically any time and probably never wait more than about a minute for a minute. Right? There's people coming at all times. You can go in the middle of the night and there's people davening there. You know, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning. I don't know if any of you guys ever tried it late at night after a Thursday night, you see there's people there. So it's an amazing thing that it turned into. Now, why did they do this? It's a crazy thing. They right away cleared it out, and that Shavuos, without anyone saying anything, en masse, people just walked from all over. People came and slept on parks in Yerushalayim, and en masse, people walked to the Kotel. It was just like a spontaneous thing. And since then, it happens every year. Okay, you guys will be at Shavuos, you know, down the tikkun on the roof, and you'll see the Kotel just packed with tens of thousands of people. People walk from all over. When I did Shiva, we walked, you know, to get here. That was part of the easy thing for me. You didn't have to work, learn the whole night. But an hour and a half before, I said, okay, so I'll walk into the Kotel. Okay, that was easier for me. But I'm saying, like, it became the, like I said, the Beit Knesset HaMerkazi, the great synagogue. Moshe Dayan, even on that first Friday, davened with 4,000 Muslims at the Alaska Mosque.
Why?
Hoping that this show of tolerance will lead to peace. Right? That was the goal.
It never works.
I don't disagree with you. I'm just, like I said, I don't have any answers. I'm not telling you what should be done. I'm telling you historically what has been done. And one of my favorite quotes, I don't remember who said it though, is the only thing we learn from history is that we never learn from history. Right? It's important to know our history, to know where we failed. Okay, you could possibly say it's a new situation. But Albert Einstein once said, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Right? So that is sometimes what happens. People assume that we'll just try it again, it'll work this time. So it is important to know what has been attempted and failed. It's very important to know. Like I said, I'm not smarter than any of the politicians. I'm not telling you what should be done. I don't have the answers. Okay? But I'm just telling you what hasn't worked in the past. Yeah, someone had their hand up? Yeah.
Why when you're getting up to Kotel Plaza, why didn't they clear out the building and fill up like that big building was like on all that? So like it's like this building that is also like kind of the Kotel. Why didn't they clear all that up?
I don't know. What they did leave is that bridge that we see, the Mugabri Bridge, that people go up that was left on purpose. I'm not sure if I know you know what building you're talking about.
That was there, the bridge?
The bridge that was there before.
That looks new.
Oh, no, well, yeah, the planks and stuff like that. There was an entrance way with the bridge that was then falling apart and somebody going down. Israel didn't want some tourists to get hurt, so they built up the bridge. But that was there before. Okay, just not in good condition.
Hey, but yeah. I'm really sorry. I can't wait, and I shouldn't be asking questions. I'm just asked her.
Yeah.
But what happened exactly? Like, basically, Jews came and cleaned this land, and we decided to give back most of Yeretika to them.
No. Yeretika is ours. Harabayit is ours. Harabayit b'yadeinu. But Moshe Dayan said we're going to let the Muslims continue to worship on Harabayit as they had done now. For, you know, dozens of centuries, because we Jews can't go up there anyway, so we're going to allow them to do this, thinking that if we were to tear down the mosque, if we destroy things, it would cause an international, it possibly cause World War III. So I'm just saying, like, okay, like I said, I'm not, it. All the hawks in Israel criticize them, saying, how about Bidin? Also, it's not Bidin. We give it up. There are people that wanted to claim, or Gordon was one of them, that we should put a shul on Harabayit. That there are places the same way now, there are people that walk up on Harabayit, right? Israel wants to go. Okay? There are places where, depending on, you know, who you ask, people can go. So Gordon wanted to build a shul on Harabai. Get as close as we can to the Makom HaMikdash. And daven there. I'm pretty sure Gordon actually did. Or, no, we can't see from here. But where he davened, I think, over, like, you know, when you go underneath the Lakota, right? See, he had some place where he went up on top, overlooking Har Habayit. He was right up there, and that's where he would daven. What?
Where the Magaf place is, up there?
Maybe. And he would daven up there.
That's what I'm asking.
But he wanted to have a shul on Har Habayit. In other words, make it our place. Muslims don't go up here. It's our holy site. Moshe Dayan thought that way. Okay? And since then, he sort of wanted to maintain status quo. Okay? Hoping that everyone would say, oh, that's great. Okay?
Yeah, that's not my question.
That's not what happened. Yeah. But Eretz Yisrael is ours.
What I'm trying to say is, it's ours, right? Why are there 30,000 Muslims living here?
Israel didn't evacuate anybody.
It didn't evacuate anybody, didn't it? So they're just kept here?
But yeah. They're just citizens of Israel.
Why can't we keep them out?
Okay, two reasons. One, it's immoral.
Immoral. So, I'm sorry, how does war work?
How does the world work?
How does war work?
War. Look, there are times. I'm not disagreeing with you. There are times where when an enemy attacks, so you say, that's it, we're not going to keep you in our midst, and we're going to kick you out. And that happened, I think, of Germans from Czechoslovakia and stuff like that, things like that happened after World War II.
Happened to the Jews
You're
everywhere.
Right. What?
Happened to the Jews everywhere.
Happened to the Jews everywhere, whether it's a war or not. That's something else. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't always happen. Usually, just they're conquered and they become citizens of the ruling power. Right? That's usually what happens. So here now, they became citizens of Israel.
Why didn't they evacuate if there was war in front of their face?
Why what?
Why wouldn't they evacuate if there was war here?
Evacuate who?
Like, why wouldn't the Muslims evacuate if they knew there was going to be a war in the whole city?
So, maybe they did. Maybe some did. We know by 1948 a lot of people evacuated. I have no idea if they evacuated now. I don't know. Okay? But it could be they didn't think that there would be a problem, that they would be safe. And now they stayed, and they now become citizens of Israel. Okay. Now, here's the interesting thing. All the miracles of the Six-Day War, all of the territorial gain, was all by accident. None of it was planned. The only part of the war was planned was to take out the air bases of Egypt because of the threat that Egypt posed by bringing all the tanks up in the Sinai, hoping that that would deter them from any, you know, war plans. In other words, Israel did not plan on capturing Sinai, did not plan on conquering the West Bank, did not plan on conquering the Golan Heights. All of that, as we tried to describe when we're going through, happened sort of by accident. Had Egypt accepted a ceasefire on the first day, Israel would have looked very different. Had Jordan decided not to get involved, believed the propaganda of Egypt, and captured refrained from seizing Government Hill, so then Israel would never capture the Old City and wouldn't have gotten the West Bank, Judea, and Samaria. Because Moshe Dayan was saying, we have enough on our hands dealing with Egypt. And had Dayan not done about face the last 2 days of the war and given the green light to go and finally, you know, respond to all the attacks from Syria, we wouldn't have had the Golan Heights. None of that was planned. None of it was planned. It was sort of thrust upon us, and amazing things happened. Now, for us as religious Jews, what major things happen aside from all this amazing territorial gain, and not just territorial gain, but of holy sites, of the places that are in Tanakh, right? We captured not just the Old City, but we went on and we got Kiryat Arba, and we settled it. Another thing that the government did, right? I mean, it was pushed again. We had some Jews that went to Hebron, and they went for Pesach, and then they refused to leave, and they sort of facts on the ground. One of those people, it's very cool, this guy that was like a Madrich sort of tour guide when I was in BMT. And I went to his house on Purim. I knew this guy was a student of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, and he knew everybody. It was crazy. Every time we went on a trip, wherever we were, anyone on the street was saying, Yankala! What's it going? He knew everyone. It's crazy how we knew everybody. Okay, fine. You know, when Natan Sharansky was being held prisoner, some crazy thing, I don't know why, Yankel Levine, this guy, was taking his wife, Avital, around the world. This guy was like, had his hand in everything. He was always involved in everything. So anyway, Purim, I go to bring him Shalach Manos. He's plastered, and he starts saying, and he starts saying, why is there a chevra because of me? He's like talking about how it was his idea as a student, and he pushed certain rabbanim to that they should have this whole plan, which they executed, to go there to get government permission to go there for Pesach, and then they refused to leave. And they established all these facts on the ground, and eventually the government gave in, and you had this community in Hebron. Right? These children of the people who were massacred in Gush Etzion. Those remember, we talked about Gush Etzion, people mowed down by the Jordanians. Their children, including later be a Knesset member, Harav Hanan Parat, went back and they reformed Gush Etzion. So certain areas that were, went back. But for us, aside from the territorial gain, Am Yisrael changed. And it was an attitudinal change. Bali Tshuva, right? This concept that we're so familiar with. No one even heard of the concept until 1967, basically. Because there were very few. It was few and far between. But what happened? After 1967, in the United States, is an awakening of Jews. And people start all of a sudden being proud to be Jewish. Up until then, who wanted to say that they're Jewish? People were changing their last names. No one wanted to be identified as a Jew. Did have, get cosmetic surgery to change their Jewish noses. I remember when I was going out with my wife, I got my nose broken playing basketball. I tried to get a rebound from some guy that's 6'8". I got up to his elbow, and as far as I got up, I broke my nose. And she goes, "Oh great, now you get a nose job." I said, "That's the only Jewish feature I have. I have blonde hair, blue eyes. I'm not getting a nose job." So people were embarrassed to be Jewish. I know two guys whose parents named them Peter because they were Holocaust survivors. We don't want it to happen again. And now people are proud to be Jews. People are walking around, and they start looking into it, and they start asking about their religion. And Eishet Torah, opens up. Or Sameach opens up. They start opening up. People start flocking. I want to learn about my Jewishness. Right? It's an amazing thing. This is what the Six-Day War did. More than in America, Russia. Russia. Here it is. Communist Russia had knocked out a couple of generations of Jews. Okay? You weren't allowed to study Jewish studies for generations already. Since the beginning of World War I. And now, all of a sudden, after 67, I'll tell you what happened. Here's a crazy thing. Okay, when I did my, very, very shortened army service, as I told you, I did it with 54 Russians, almost all of them named Sasha. Okay, they're all there, and they're telling me about, we're trading, about America and Russia. It always was crazy. Why did I leave America to come to Israel? They only came to Israel because they couldn't get into America. It was crazy for them. Who would leave America? Anyway, so I said, this is where Jews should live. So they're telling me about what it was like in Russia. So some of them were old enough, some of them, this is a story they heard from their parents. 67. On the Russian radio, they're talking about the upcoming war. They're talking about how Syria is moving their tanks and how Egypt's moving their tanks. They are broadcasting all of the belligerent remarks by these Arab leaders, how they're going to drive Israel into the sea. And it's obvious why we spoke before. Russia is the one that pushed them to do all this. Exciting news, right? War breaks out. And then, nothing. And then hours go by, and nothing. And a whole day goes by, and more nothing. And Jews start to smile. Because no news is good news. Because if Israel is being demolished, it would be on the radio. And by the second day, they're dancing in the streets. Third day, fourth day, more no news. This must be amazing. Right? And Jews all of a sudden start to have a Jewish identity. And they start to feel, and when they finally figure out what happened, Jews wake up. Jews wake up. Sharansky, why did he get in trouble? Because it was one of the coolest moments in Israel's history, the state of Israel's history, a non-war moment. 1977, Israeli basketball team is playing Russia. So first of all, they play against Russia, and Anatoly Sharansky unfolds a humongous big Israeli flag, you know, in the stands there, and he gets arrested. Okay, fine.
Who was that?
Jewish press. Sharansky. You have to learn about Natan Sharansky. I'll tell you about him in a second. 1977, they're playing a European tournament. And in the semifinals, Israel beats Russia. They end up going on to beat, I forgot right now, who no one really cared for the championship. But beating Russia, it was like David against Goliath, right? Little Israel. The star of the team is this guy, Tal Brody. Tal Brody is a Jew who played University of Kentucky, I'm pretty sure.
Damn.
Okay? He had come to Israel for the Maccabiah. Okay? For those who don't know, Maccabiah is the Jewish Olympics. And he fell in love with the country. And even though he was like, I don't know what it was, something like the 14th pick in the draft or 16th pick in the draft, he decided to come to Israel. This is when there were less teams. So that was like 12 teams. He was like beginning of the second round, you know? There were only like 12 teams in the league at that time. So let's say he's 14th pick. He was like, okay, one of the first round picks, second round pick, but still. He was first team All-American. He's a good basketball player. He comes to Israel, and Israel starts to make a good team. And by 1977, Israel wins the championship, the European championship. And this famous big plate all the time, Tal Brody is an icon in Israel. This thick American accent. He says, Yisrael al hamapa. You know, we're on the map, and you know, whatever. So in Russia, this arouses this awakening thing of all these Jews. They now say, I want to make Aliyah. And Russia won't let them. And they become refusenicks. When I was a kid, when I was in Hank, we're going and we're doing Solidarity Sunday. We're demonstrating in front of the Russian embassy in New York. Let my people go. We have all these signs and everything. Let the Jews out of Russia. All of that started because of the Six-Day War. All of it started because this Jewishness was aroused in them. And people now say they feel Jewish. They want to come back to Israel. One guy, Yosef Mendelovich. How much did he want to come to Israel? He tried to hijack a plane to Israel. Okay, he and three friends tried to hijack a plane. He was arrested. He was caught. He was in Israel. He is known as Yosef HaTzadik. This guy he was from throughout all his time in Russia, in jail. He and Sharansky, how brilliant were these people?
Who's Sharansky?
Okay, Sharansky is like one of my heroes. Natan Sharansky. He would demonstrate on behalf of freedom. And he was charged, trumped up charges that he was working for the CIA. And the night of his wedding, like right after he gets married, he gets pulled away and he's thrown into prison. And there's trumped up charges and there's a trial. And he says, like, I forgot the whole speech, you can look it up. He ends up by saying, you know, to you, the judges and the jury in Russia, I don't remember, says, I have nothing to say because your conclusion was a foregone conclusion. But to my people, to my wife Avital, I have one thing to say. And like this is, you know, what he says. And he's in jail for, I think, 11 years, and he's in solitary. And with Yosef Mendelovich, he's also thrown into solitary. They can't see each other. But they use the same shower, okay, different times. So they play chess in their minds, and they would write a move and put it in the soap bar, you know, rook to, you know, to queen four, but I mean, whatever. And then the guy would, and they kept it in their minds, this whole, and they play. And once, Sharansky wrote a thing, and then the next thing goes, I can't believe you wrote yesterday was Shabbos. Like he's giving a mussar. Like Sharansky didn't know anything. What did he know? And Sharansky got him. He was able to have a Tanakh. Okay? Now, turns out, like 11 years go by, he's in solitary, and based on all sorts of pressure, Sharansky is pulled out of his jail. It's the middle of the winter. Okay? He is brought to a bridge, and there's cars on this side of the bridge. It's cars on the other side of the bridge. Said, "You're free. Go to the other side. They're waiting for you." And he says, "Where's my Tanakh?" He said, "Back in the prison." He sits on the floor in the snow. Who does that? "I'm not budging until I get my Tanakh." And then go back to the prison and get his Tanakh to give it to him so he wouldn't go. Who does that? He's like, it's amazing. He has so much self-respect.
Did they take him away on purpose?
They grabbed him out of the cell and he didn't know what's going on. They grabbed him and they took him. They didn't tell him you're going free. He writes in his book, they used to like make fun of him, saying, "Mothers and children are demonstrating for you in New York." I mean, like, no one that matters. And then he writes in his book, "Those mothers and children gave my freedom. All that pressure that was put on the Kremlin finally gained my freedom." Because they tried to torment me, it didn't help. Right? He ends up coming to Israel. He eventually becomes a Knesset member. It's crazy. He becomes a Knesset member. He comes back as like a minister of the government, visits Russia.
It's my boy.
And he's like, I read his books, one of the most, I'll tell you the name of the book.
Yeah, man.
Fear No Evil. Fear No Evil's autobiography, Anatoly Sharansky. Okay, Fear No Evil. I read this book, and it was like, wow. I just like, okay, he's my hero. So when he ran for Knesset, I voted for him. Unfortunately, I was like the only one, so you know, he didn't get it.
Was he right
but, he was in for once, and then he didn't get reelected. But you know, but I said I get to vote for someone that I respect, and I
still
respect
a Geber, him. It's okay.
He's a Geber. At one point, my mother-in-law came over to me and my wife and said, "Oh, someone said I want to like set up my son Ellie with like his daughter." And like we said, you know, yeah, we're not making shidduchim for our kids, you know, like whatever. But thanks, you know. But anyway, so he's like, and then when he came to Israel, his wife was already totally from. She'd already become totally from. He was by himself in jail. He wasn't from. But he's like with his wife, and he would always wear like an army hat. And he felt that this is what unifies on Israel. Little did he know in the beginning that some people think the army doesn't unify, but whatever. So he would walk around with a little army hat. Everyone would be wearing suits or nothing. He's wearing a little army hat with his whatever. But okay, fine. So that's Sharansky. I'm saying Russia. He woke up. Oh, wow. I gotta move. I feel like I'm on Thursday night when I'm running out of time. Now, what happens here is a crazy thing. People start coming up with solutions. What should we do with the Arabs? You know, some left say no Jews should move in anywhere. So that when the Arabs are ready to make peace, we just give back all the land in total. Other Jews, who felt that this was so miraculous, it's clearly a sign from God, said, "This is the most Mashiach, it's time to settle all the land." So the government basically found themselves somewhere in the middle of these two views and tried to come up with solutions. And then you have like the Alon plan. Okay, let's let these certain areas will be under our rule, we'll move people in there. The rest of the area, we will leave open for the Arabs. And then other people said no, and they started negotiating. But with who? With each other. The Arabs never said yes to anything. So what happened is, Jews are negotiating, right wing with left wing, and then the right wing, okay, they come down more to the left wing, and the negotiation getting worse and worse and worse, but the Arabs never had to do anything. We're smart people, we're very stupid when it comes to this negotiating. And the Arabs went, it's just like now. What happened? Ehud Olmert once offered basically everything to the Arabs, and it was refused. Okay, refused by the Arabs. Now, the Palestinian leader, Mahmoud Abbas, says, all right, any negotiations we do should start from where Olmert, you know, said before. Well, but you rejected that. You want to go back to that? But that's what they do. Say, oh, that was once a suggestion. Let's go back to there and we'll start from there. So this is what's happening. We keep negotiating with ourselves, and the situation gets worse and worse. Now, right afterwards, Israel says, let's make peace. United Nations, let's make peace. And it's well known, Arab leaders get together, and it's known as the famous three no's. They said no peace with Israel, no negotiations with Israel, no recognition of Israel. Okay, very famous line by Avi Eben, who was then the foreign minister of Israel, said the Arabs have never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Okay? Okay, and unfortunately for them, This continues till today. Okay? Never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. Goes back to Ehud Olmert offering the, you know, everything. Barack offered everything. No.
Back to everything.
Yeah, even like, okay, we'll divide up even Harabayit. You'll have like the top of the bottom. Weird stuff. Nothing. Now what happens is the Arabs start suing that they want to get all their land back, which of course is no precedent for in history because the Arabs attacked. Right? The Arabs attacked. If you attack and you can always get back your land, what's to stop you from attacking in the future? Right? There's no deterrent. The whole idea is you attack, you lost, you lose. Right? Germany attacked twice. Their land was then divvied up amongst European countries. Japan attacked and they lost. America was in Okinawa for like 26 years, even though it was 5,000 miles away from their homeland to keep it safe, you know? And yet, what does the international community tell Israel? Okay, let's do land for peace. Give them back their land, and they'll give you a piece of paper. That's basically, you know, land for peace. That is what the international... Why does the international community do this? Very, very simple. Because there are 18 Arab states, United Nations, with hundreds of millions of residents who are consumers for Western products and who has oil that Western countries need. What does Israel have to offer anybody? Do we have a lot of consumers to buy products? No. What do we have to offer? Not much. So therefore, it might be immoral, but most countries run by what's expedient. What's in our best interest? It's in our best interest not to ruffle feathers of the Arabs. We need them. We don't need Israel. If our decisions would somehow also be moral, well, that'd be great. You know, if that can work, that would be fantastic. So then they came up with what's called United Resolution 242, that basically is land for peace, that if, you know, Israel should relinquish territories, it doesn't say all the territories, there's a lot of stuff going on talking about that. Let's say the territories, but territories. Then the Arabs would live in peace. So the Arabs sort of disregard the second part, and they read it as all territories, and that's certainly not what it means, but that's the way they read it. Okay?
Territories
being what? Anything that was conquered in the Six-Day War. Absolutely everything. Okay? Now one could make the argument after the peace accord with Egypt that we already gave back 91% we gave away to Sinai.
If they don't keep their end, then why should we keep our end?
I agree with you. That is really, that's how any Sinai but Egypt works.
Egypt was the same thing as thing as the Arabs.
What?
Egypt was the same thing as Palestine. Like
there was no Palestine.
Palestine. Like they caused the same
Egypt
problem.
Wants all their land back. That was captured.
Like
Syria wants all the land back.
They caused
all the land back.
What they want, like, would they cause the same problems as things did?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm just running out of time, so I want to just show you maps. Okay, just so you get an idea. This I already showed you before. You see, by the highlighted area, all the land that was captured. Now, Syria wants the Golan Heights back. Look how tiny the Golan Heights is. It's a little white thing over here, the bottom of Syria, right? This is what they're fighting about. They want the Golan Heights back. Okay, now why is the Golan Heights so important for us? Okay, you look over here, the Golan Heights, shooting down onto the Galil. Right? See this high point? Shooting down onto the Galil. Now what happened? Here's Israel, here's the Golan Heights, here's Syria. We now control the Golan Heights, and now from on top of this high point, we look down into Syria. Now, you guys will go up to the Golan Heights later in the year. We have all these radar stations, everything up there. We know exactly what's going on in Syria. Beforehand, exact opposite, they're shooting down at us. Here's Yehuda v'Shomron. And you look at this map, and if we were to give to the Palestinians what was then Jordan, look how tiny, look how narrow Israel is, right? What does it say over here? 9 miles to Netanya, 11 miles to Tel Aviv, 22 to Ashdod, Ashkelon is 7 miles from Gaza. This is why this whole Otev Gaza, missiles are firing all the time from here. Imagine if they had all of this shooting at just a little on the shoulder at planes landing and taking off from Ben Gurion Airport. Because that could be done. right? From your shoulder. You don't even need something bigger than that. Right? It would wreak havoc. And now you understand why Israel's not ready to say, oh yeah, we'll just give you back all the land. What?
Also, it's our land.
It's our land. Right. But I'm saying, like, let's say you have peace, which I don't think you would ever have. I once had a t-shirt when I was walking through the shuk that I would have bought because I really believe in it, except that I didn't want to give them any money. But the t-shirt was a guy barreled over laughter, and it said peace in the Middle East. Right? So, like, I don't think there's going to be peace in the Middle East till Mashiach. I don't think there's going to be peace in the Middle East till Mashiach comes. Right? What I'm hoping for is Sheket, going back to Sefer Shoftim. You know? And there was Sheket for 20 years. Sheket for 40 years. Sheket, yeah. Peace? I don't see that happening until Mashiach comes. All right. We'll stop over here.